Welcome to Asia Rising, a podcast from La Trobe Asia, where we discuss news, views, and general happenings of Asian states and societies. I'm your host, Matt Smith. While the 20th century saw the collapse of monarchies across Europe, recent events are a reminder that hereditary monarchies still matter in Asia. In some countries like Malaysia and Bhutan, the institution is thriving, but they can struggle for relevancy given the pro-democracy movements in Thailand and fast modernizing landscapes of Japan. Here to discuss Asia and the modern monarchy is La Trobe University's Vice Chancellor Fellow, Emeritus Professor Dennis Altman. Thank you for joining me, Dennis.
Hi, Matt.
Good to finally get you on an episode of Asia Rising, by the way. He's the author of more published books than Charles Dickens, including the most recently, God Save the Queen, The Strange Persistence of Monarchies. Did you know that? More books than Dickens?
I was wondering actually what that was based on, but I'm delighted if that's the case. I should, however, point out that his books were somewhat longer.
However you want to pass it. So let's discuss the monarchies of Asia. What countries retain a monarchy? And how would you characterise their position in modern society? Just a kind of broad nutshell.
I think what's interesting about Asia, and is rather different to the European setup, is that you have the full range. So you go from Japan, which has a constitutional monarchy where the emperor literally has no political power. He has far less political power, for example, than the Queen of England. Mm. You go from that right through to the absolute monarchies that you find in the Gulf. A number of the Gulf states are absolute monarchies, such as Saudi Arabia most famously, but also Brunei in our part of the world, where the Sultan of Brunei is the absolute ruler and has full control of the government. And in between that, you have variations so that Thailand is theoretically a constitutional monarchy, but the King of Thailand has very much more political power than any European constitutional monarch would have. You referred to Bhutan, where the king does have a considerable amount of political power, although it has been democratized to some extent over the last few decades. Malaysia, which is basically a system combining the traditional sultans, and the kingship of Malaysia rotates among the nine hereditary sultans of the different states, but the Malaysian king essentially governs according to the sorts of assumptions of a constitutional monarch.
Mm. So there's such a variety there. Why do you think that the monarchies of Europe in particular get more focus and more attention than the ones in Asia do? Or am I just asking the wrong audience by asking that question?
No, I think what you're asking is a really sensible question, but it's a reflection of the fact that Australia culturally still behaves as if we were situated somewhere in the English Channel. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, what we hear about is nonstop.
Sorry, the way you phrase that infers that we were in the English Channel at some point. We're just on a holiday at the moment. Big booze
well,
up.
Yes, that's true. We've drifted a little bit. But I think ideologically, culturally, the extraordinary obsession of the Australian media with the British royals. I know they are theoretically also our royals. But I think what's interesting is that very few Australians actually think of them as our royals, but they're the ones who get the attention. And Australia is in some ways an extraordinary parochial society, so that really the only other royal in Europe that I think gets much attention in Australia is Princess Mary of Denmark, because Princess Mary of Denmark grew up in Tasmania.
Oh, I completely forgot about that. I'm here going, why should we worry about Denmark? Oh, that's right, she did.
Matt,
yeah.
I also grew up in
Tasmania.
Sorry,
I need
Princess
to keep
Mary
up on my new idea.
Like
sorry.
I have been fascinated talking about my book, which does try to talk about monarchies in both Asia and Europe. I've been fascinated how hard it has been to get most interviewers to be interested in Asia, even though there's a much greater variety, as you said at the beginning, of monarchical systems in Asia. And some of the countries where there are monarchies, I mean, let's face it, Japan, Malaysia, Thailand, they're much more significant to Australia than, say, Norway or, shall we say, Luxembourg.
Yeah.
The Grand Duke of Luxembourg is hardly going to be a significant person in Australia's foreign policy.
Okay, well, let's talk in detail then about a few of the monarchies that we've name-dropped and mentioned. But there is so many, you know, varieties that you could do a podcast on each quite easily and still have material to talk about. So if you were to provide a few notes for new idea about which monarchies they should be focusing on for their next issue, say, for example, I guess that the King of Thailand would be quite far up your list, wouldn't he?
Thailand is probably the most interesting and, I would say, disturbing example. Thailand is a country in which the monarchy is a central fundamental part of, I think, the national identity. Mm. The role of the monarchs in preserving Thai independence back in the 19th century, when the British and the French were encroaching upon Thailand from both frontiers, is, I think, really important. Anyone who's been in Thailand will be aware of the extent to which images of the monarch are omnipresent, the way in which Thai television every night begins with the national anthem and images of the king. Now, Thailand had, of course, for a very long period, the previous king, King Bhumibol, deeply revered, played a very interesting role, claiming to be a constitutional monarch, but interpreting that in ways that are rather different to what we in the British tradition would assume are correct. So, on some occasions, he actually supported democratically elected governments. On other occasions, he supported coups that overthrew democratically elected governments. He died, of course, a few years ago, and his son, whom I think a polite term would be as somewhat eccentric, is now a very powerful monarch and is indeed, and this may be of interest to New Idea, almost certainly the richest monarch in the world. And the riches of the Thai monarchy are quite extraordinary. And the current king has managed to increase the family holdings to the point where he is even richer than the Sultan of Brunei, who used to probably be the richest monarch in Asia. Over the last few years, as I'm sure people know, there have been a number of popular rebellions against the Thai government, which is not a democratically elected government, and they've extended into criticisms of the monarch. Not, I think, many calls to overthrow the monarchy, rather a desire to see a monarchy that is more like the constitutional monarchies that we're familiar with in Europe. And in fact, there was a very interesting discussion I took part in a couple of years ago. I mentioned in my book, where a very senior former Thai politician said that people in Thailand had been watching episodes of The Crown to understand better how a constitutional monarchy worked.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. The Thai king does not just hold a lot of power, but exercise it quite regularly. There's kind of no qualms at intervening in the politics of the country.
Yeah. Thailand, as far as I can tell, and it's not necessarily that clear, essentially power is held in a sort of tripartite way between the palace, the army, and some very powerful business interests. And the king certainly has very considerable political power, which he may or may not exercise. I mean, he certainly doesn't do it on a day-to-day level. He's not the head of government in the way that the Sultan of Brunei or the king of several Persian Gulf states exercises it. But the king is protected by very strong lese majeste laws. A number of people in Thailand currently are in jail for having criticised the monarch. And the veneration of the monarchy is, I think, an essential part of the way in which the ruling military elite maintain their power, so that it's hard to be quite certain how much power the king himself might exercise on a day-to-day basis. At the moment, as we're speaking, Matt, probably not that much, because the king, as he likes to do, has taken himself off with quite a large retinue of followers to Germany, where he spends a lot of time living in very lavish hotels surrounded by large numbers of fans and admirers.
Yeah, he spends more time in Germany than he does in Thailand. It seems that he's coming back only really for ceremonial reasons when he's required.
Yes, I think he did spend a considerable part of the last 12 months in Thailand because of the political situation. The last news that I've been able to find suggests that He returned to, I think, Munich because he felt the situation had quietened down and there was no real threat to the institution of monarchy. But nonetheless, there is something a little odd about a monarch with considerable power spending so much of his time in luxurious resorts, 8,000 kilometres away from his own country.
And there's been question marks over his behaviour, his conduct, his personality, and just him in general. Does that change the veneration between the current king and his father, who was in the throne and revered for so long?
Oh, I think inevitably. I think that the story of what's happened in Thailand, if we were able to move forwards and look back on it from, say, 20 years hence, is going to be a great tragedy, because had the current king come in as other kings in similar situations have done, with a view to modernise and democratise Thai society, he could have done an extraordinary job. And the very veneration that he's held in is exactly why he's in a position to guide Thailand into a more democratic structure. In fact, Thailand has moved backwards under the current regime. And I think that's very sad. And it does, of course, underline the great problem of monarchy. The great problem of monarchy is that if you base your monarch on the hereditary principle, that's a big gamble. I mean, just think of it, for example, in terms of Britain. Probably the British should be very pleased that Prince Charles, rather than Prince Andrew, is the eldest son of Queen Elizabeth.
Especially given the current climate. Let's take the focus over then to Japan. The role of emperor is interesting, notwithstanding the fact that the dynasty managed to survive the aftermaths of World War II.
It did.
And if you look into the background of the royal family, this one bloodline essentially dates back to mythological origins, if the track record is to be believed. There's quite a lot that is very unique about Japan.
It's, I think, the longest lasting extant royal family anywhere. And of course, I think the point you made is really important. The Japanese emperor survived because the United States, when they occupied Japan after World War II, felt this was necessary for stability. And interestingly, and this is in a way relates back to the discussion about Thailand, the fact that the emperor was able to accept and work with a new liberal democratic system, of course, gave great legitimacy to that system, rather as happened in Spain after the end of Franco, when King Juan Carlos was able to preside over transition to a democratic society. Now, we're talking at this stage of several emperors past. Emperor Hirohito, who was there at the end of World War II, the Japanese emperor, as I said at the beginning, has no political power at all. He, however, is a symbol of the nation. And interestingly, he occasionally will say things that seem to suggest a slightly more moderate, softer tone than has been true of most post-war Japanese governments. I think that successive emperors have actually been quite important in trying to heal some of the wounds left over from World War II with countries like China and Korea.
How did it survive then? Was it seen as being not too much of a threat and too important to the culture and the persona of Japan itself?
Look, I think that in many countries, people's sense of the nation is very much bound up with a royal family. And that's certainly true in Japan. It's certainly true in Thailand. If we go to Europe, it seems to be true in the Scandinavian countries, which one would expect, given that they are among the most liberal democratic countries in the world, would long ago have abolished the monarchy, have clung to the monarchs, because I think they see it as a way of cementing national identity. The Japanese emperor, therefore, is a very important national symbol and I think reassures a lot of Japanese that there's a certain amount of continuity, there's the connection to the past, there's the connection to a whole imperial history going back many centuries. And because none of the post-war Japanese emperors have, in effect, ever done anything to upset people, they've retained their standing. Now, that's been at some cost. I mean, both the current empress and the previous empress, and it's known publicly, have had severe problems with stress and anxiety as a consequence of having to play a very rigid royal role. And Japan, of course, is a country in which ceremony and tradition is very important. Any royal, even in the most democratic countries like, say, the Netherlands or Norway, still has to perform. And the stress on several of the Japanese empresses has clearly been quite extraordinary.
Mm.
And in fact, the previous emperor, rather like some of the British royals, have complained about the way in which the media have treated members of the family.
Mm-hmm. And you do hear bits and pieces about those royals in the news, especially most recently, I guess, when the princess resigned her title to marry a commoner.
I'm doing
quotation fingers here.
This is not uncommon, you know. There are quite a number of royals over the last century or so who've done that.
Mm.
I only know of two cases, however, where somebody has left the position of being monarch. We're usually talking about members of the royal family who give up their royal privileges and royal titles to marry out.
Mm.
Of course, the famous case is King Edward VIII, who abdicated in Britain in 1937 so he could marry Wallace Simpson.
Yes, I've seen The Crown, I remember. Yeah,
yeah, and it appears regretted it ever since. But there is also the case that is far less well known, but actually I think much more interesting, which is King Carol of Romania, who was the heir apparent in Romania. And after a couple of public and very unfortunate love affairs, basically said, well, I've had enough of this, I'm giving it up. Was disinherited. His younger brother, Prince Michael, therefore became king when Dad died. Carol in exile decided he'd made a great mistake, came back, kicked his brother off the throne, made himself king, was king of Romania through most of the 1930s. And now he's dead, I can say this, almost certainly the worst king in Europe in the 20th century.
Now that he's dead, you can say that.
Yes. Well, I'd be very careful. I mean, I always thought, Matt, we could have a competition as to who is the sleaziest current member of any royal family, but I'm not sure I want to risk my life by naming names on air.
I'll look out for your next book for that, I guess, to be published by New Idea. All right, we've gone very gossipy, so I'm going to veer us back into Asia, which is kind of tangentially, I suppose. If we talk about the example of Malaysia, which is a very different one, and maybe if Harry was living under this system, he'd get a turn as the king for a while. So Malaysia has a rotating monarchy system. It almost feels a bit democratic in a sense, as in you've got a term limit of 5 years once you become the king.
Well, yes, but you have to be a member of the royal family to get there.
Yeah,
I wouldn't overdo the democracy in that.
And there's a religious element to it as well. So talk me through that.
Well, basically, in Malaysia, the states that have traditional sultans, which are pretty well all heavily Muslim majority states, those nine sultans, as you say, Matt, rotate the kingship between them. They meet every 5 years and elect someone, usually on the basis of seniority. I mean, it's fairly polite. God knows what goes on behind the scenes, but usually it's a polite transition to the next in line. Within their own states, the sultans often exercise quite considerable influence. As king of the Federation of Malaysia, less so. And in fact, Dr. Mahathir, in his various periods as prime minister, quite deliberately cut back the powers of the sovereign and was disliked by the royals. This is important because people may remember that the year before last, Dr. Mahathir did this very strange manoeuvre when, as prime minister, he resigned but expected to be reappointed.
Mm.
The king said, no, I'm not going to reappoint you. And under the constitution, the king does have the right to appoint a prime minister and then to decide himself whether that prime minister can build a majority in the Malaysian parliament. So Mahathir, in a sense, was kicked out by his own over-cleverness. And ever since then, the current Malaysian king has actually played somewhat of a more obvious role in politics, but one that I would argue is probably consistent with being a constitutional monarch. And the problem in Malaysia is there are fluctuating majorities in parliament. It's been very difficult for anyone to have a clear majority. And at the same time, there's been tension between the king and the prime ministers as to when parliament should sit. And my understanding is that the current king has actually behaved quite properly. I think, again, it's very hard to imagine the end of this system in Malaysia, because the king, given that he is a sultan with a strong link to the dominant Islamic and therefore Malay tradition, is so important in the eyes of Malay Malaysians that to remove him would, I think, be seen as a great blow. And as people will know, there is always this tension underlying life in Malaysia between the status of the majority Malay population and then the very large numbers of people in Malaysia who are of Chinese, Indian, or other origins.
Okay, so we've talked about a few different monarchies there, and there are other systems of monarchy around, not just Asia, but in the wider world. Is there a system of monarchy that can comfortably coexist with a democratic government, or do you think that they're too much at odds with each other to really gel well?
No, I think that there are a number of examples. I think if you look at the Scandinavian countries or the Benelux countries, you know, Netherlands, Belgium, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, they're all, and indeed Japan, are all cases where the monarch plays the role of a national symbol who is seen as somehow representing the country above and beyond the political. That is, I think, reassuring to many people. That is certainly quite consistent. We're talking about countries in which clearly liberal democracies flourish, so there is no inconsistency. And I think for smaller countries particularly, a monarch is actually very useful. I mean, think about the way in which someone like Queen Margarita of Denmark, who's been on the throne now for, I don't know, 30 to 40 years, when she travels and represents Denmark overseas, she will get much more attention than if it were a prime minister who'd been in office for 6 months. So that I think for some countries where they've found a way of removing the political powers of the monarchy, there are some real advantages. I hasten to say, I have to say this every time, none of this applies in a situation like Australia, where we pretend we have a monarch, but actually our monarch sits 12,000 miles away, and we have to make do with a governor general substitute whom virtually nobody can name.
I can't.
No, I've tested this. It's actually very interesting. I sat at a table
with some
quite well-known literary figures in Sydney, and none of them could tell me who was the current Governor General.
Now I don't feel so bad. In the case of Asia, though, do you think that the monarchy gets in the way of democracy in Asia?
Well, I don't think. I think we always come back to this problem that Asia is, of course, half the world, and so you can't make generalizations about Asia.
Yeah.
I think that we would have to ask this country by country. It used to be said, for example, by people who were basically leftists, would argue under the previous monarch in Thailand, they would say, look, yes, there are some problems. Yes, the monarch has too much power, but look at the countries around us. We've done a lot better with our monarchy than the surrounding countries such as Burma, Vietnam, Cambodia. I'm not sure how much they would want to argue that today under the current king in Thailand. I think that the stability and continuation of Malaysia probably does benefit from the monarchy. I think that the current king has probably been quite important over the last couple of years in maintaining some sort of political stability. On the other hand, certainly if we go to some of the countries in the Persian Gulf, Saudi Arabia, it'd be very hard to argue that the sorts of autocratic powers and extraordinary wealth retained by the royal families is defensible. And even where we are talking about constitutional monarchies being possible, there are real questions about the resources. I mean, the previous king of Thailand might well have been loved and venerated and was very good at going into rural Thailand and blessing village development projects. But this didn't prevent the Thai royal family amassing one of the great fortunes of Asia.
Yes, very good. I have never heard of David Hurley, apparently.
I could have told you that, Matt. But I mean, I will just make the point that when you have our system, which, you know, we share with Canada and New Zealand and Papua New Guinea and half a dozen Pacific and Caribbean islands, I actually think our system gives far too much power to the Prime Minister. I think one of the reasons that Australian Prime Ministers aren't all that enthusiastic about the Republic is they actually like a system where they get to appoint the Governor General. Now, if you think about it, Boris Johnson does not pick the monarch. Our Prime Minister gets to pick the Governor General, and the Governor General is essentially there to open flower shows.
Thanks for your time today, Dennis.
It's fun.
You've been listening to Asia Rising, a podcast from La Trobe Asia. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. You can follow La Trobe Asia on Twitter. We are at La Trobe Asia. I'm Matt Smith, and thanks for listening.